Testing.
Hi, my name is Colleen. I'm with EDUCAUSE. I'd like to welcome you all and thank you for attending this session. I also want to welcome our online audience from across the U.S. and from several international locations. As I said, this is being streamed online and it is being recorded. When we have the speaker question and answer session at the end, we'd really like you to utilize the microphones on each side of the room so our online audience can hear your questions clearly and loudly. I'd also like to encourage you to utilize the online evaluation after the session so our speakers get a chance to know how you're doing, or how they're doing, sorry. And with that, I am going to introduce our speakers today. Chris Kemp is the head of digital library services at the University of Richmond, and Eric Palmer is the director of web services also at the University of Richmond.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Last day of EDUCAUSE, last concurrent session. Glad you made it. Sometimes the last day is hard for folks. We're going to talk about collaborating across departments and how we got this one particular project done. We're not going to talk too much about the project, a little bit, but we're going to talk about the methods we use to collaborate. So as our moderator said, this is Chris Kemp and I'm Eric Palmer. Also, Scott Nesbitt with the Digital Scholarship Lab helped us prepare this presentation, was actively involved in the project, but he couldn't make it. He's actually teaching today. So we're going to get started now. We're with the University of Richmond. We're a small liberal arts school in Richmond, Virginia. We have a beautiful campus like many colleges and universities. And we're really glad that we're here. I run web services. We have a small team and we're devoted to more of the technical infrastructure and some of the back-end programming for the web. We work as a combined team with University Communications. We call ourselves kind of informally the public web team. And we do a lot of different things, but principally we have about 135 websites for the university, a couple search engines, some other things. We are 90%+ mobile ready on our pages, and recently we released a mobile iPhone app and then a couple months later an Android app. So we've done quite a lot of different things. We also do our work in a Scrum-like fashion, so if you all know Scrum or Agile, that's what we're talking about. We'll talk about that a little bit in this presentation as we proceed. So,
as Eric said, I'm Chris Kemp. I'm the head of digital library services at UR. My department and the library were the owners of the project that we're going to be talking about today. My department's relatively young in library terms, but we do a lot of things that libraries do. We like to push collections out, and primarily online to users. Our main projects focus in these three areas you see on the screen, the Civil War, the University of Richmond history, and World War II. In the past, you know, we've been really responsible for the full life cycle of projects, everything from planning and development to delivery online and then archiving the material we create. But as a result of this collaborative project, we put together a new model that seems to be working pretty well. Our collaborator and co-author of the presentation was Scott Nesbitt. He's the Associate Director of the Digital Scholarship Lab at UR, which is the Digital Humanities Center on campus. They aim primarily to use data visualizations and computational methodologies to formulate, ask, and potentially answer research questions in the humanities. And we've highlighted a couple of their big projects up here, some of their most impressive work, Mining the Dispatch and Visualizing Emancipation. So back to this work, Virginia and the Crisis of the Union. Our source material were the proceedings of the Virginia Secession Convention, which was the event in Virginia's history that resulted in the Virginia secession from the Union. The convention itself ran from February 13th through May 1st, 1861. Our data that we're working with, it's a really data-rich project. We have full-text transcriptions of the proceedings encoded in TEI XML, and we've layered that with census data and voting data that are also in XML. It's searchable and it's browsable, and it provides a few data visualizations that are context sensitive, and it's publicly accessible on the web.
Okay, briefly, the technology we use for this, we're not going to go over this whole list. Most of it is what you might expect for a PHP web application. We did use ExistDB, which is an open source XML database, which we had had a year of kind of playing with and then 1 year of production experience in the public web space before we did it. And that we did this project in 2010, so this was kind of our first foray into HTML5 Canvas. So that was kind of exciting for us and fun.
So our goal with this project was really what everybody wants for their work. It was, you know, nirvana, that state of bliss and total happiness that comes from a job well done and that expertly handled project. The charge for this work came from Dr. Edward Ayers, who is the university president, and hopefully a lot of you will go see his keynote here in about 50 minutes or so. So we got this project from the president, so we wanted to deliver, and we wanted to deliver well. Our goals up front were kind of loose, but we had a really, really tight deadline. We had 9 weeks until the president was going to be using this project to present at a couple of big name locations. All of our other work had to proceed on schedule. So there were four departments working on this project together, and we all had departmental work that needed to get done. Dr. Ayers needed to be able to use the project up front, so we really didn't have 9 weeks. We had maybe eight. He needed to be able to use the resource for discovery and to put together his presentations. The project needed to be, it needed to provide a rich user experience. It needed to be attractive and functional, usable, and on a somewhat, it needed to be more usable than a lot of digital humanities-like projects because we were aiming for middle school users and up to hit this thing. And if I didn't mention it, and I know I did, all of our other work had to proceed on schedule, and that was one of the really challenging things with four departments working together. So our project was successful, and while this presentation isn't about the product of our work, it's more about how we went about doing it, we wanted to show you some screenshots from the resource just so you could get a feel for it. This is the homepage for the site. It's collections.richmond.edu/secession, and feel free to go hit it and play around. This is really the most attractive and most intuitive interface any of our digital library collections has. This is one of the initial search mechanisms. That map you see in the middle is clickable, so users can click on counties and cities in Virginia and search the proceedings for speeches only by delegates that represented that location. This is a geographic and word density kind of view of search results, and we also provide a time plot of search results up front. So this is a kind of distant reading technique along with a pathway to the deep reading techniques because users can dive right into the proceedings by clicking on the hits below. This is a date browser that we created for it. This actually brings in some of that TEI encoded text to put together a kind of dynamic summary of what was happening on each day. And this is one of our voting visualizations. This is the first vote for secession, which actually failed. And that was something I didn't know before we started this work, that Virginia actually decided not to secede, at first at least. But we have historical context here provided by Scott Nesbitt. So like I said, outcomes, we were successful. We were on time and exceeded the president's expectations, which was really important to us. It won some awards, it got cited in presentations and blog posts and some articles, and you know, really none of these things were bad at all. But what we really decided at the end is we were really able to kind of contribute to this more powerful effort. Something that is summarized really nicely by this quote from Dr. Ayers that we all really like, so I'm going to read it to you. One way to have a fresh perspective on the Civil War is to put the power to explore the past into the people's hands.
So one of the things we're going to talk about now is how we got this work accomplished, not from a technical aspect, but from a collaboration aspect and a project management aspect. So, and then hopefully you can learn how to do some of these things, or maybe you're doing some of them and you can add to them. So we're hoping that most of you can take away some, you know, tricks and techniques to get your work done in a more collaborative and maybe faster, better, cheaper way. The first thing we're going to talk about is, as the public web team, what were we already doing, and to a certain extent, the Digital Scholarship Lab and the library as well. We had the normal kinds of competencies that you might think, web design and web building and application building. The Digital Scholarship Lab and the library had experience with TEI and coding, and the public web team had XML database usage experience. So, we also, the public web team had been collaborating two groups for some time, and we had gotten a lot of websites built and migrated into our CMS. We have two collaborative spaces. For arcane reasons, they have names. One's called the pond, hence the fish in the picture, and the other one's called the bunker. So the most important part of this, though, is that we had already been operating in a Scrum-like fashion. So how many people here know what Scrum is or have at least some recollection? And all right, so this is kind of agile Scrum, but in a light way, not fully rigorous, because of the number of projects that we have going simultaneously. This shows you one of the collaborative spaces and shows you our storyboards. The pink cards are mostly the web team work, and then the cards on the back wall are other communication work. The top cards are stories, and the cards underneath of them are tasks. So this is a stand-up where we say, this is what we've accomplished since the last stand-up, this is what we intend to accomplish before the next, and what our impediments are or what kind of problems we are anticipating. This is my web team, the bunkers room. And that's my web team right there. And then this is part of the pond space. They all sit close to each other. They can say, hey, everybody come over here and give me some feedback on this design or in this application. They also have the behaviors necessary to make it a productive environment. So everybody listens to music with headphones on. Nobody has speakers. You know, it's a fairly quiet space most of the time. But it doesn't have to be, and people can interject and say, hey, can somebody help me? And that's worked really, really well. The next concept, however, and this is really important, and this is something that I brought to the university from my prior employment, and that is to make your work that you do all the time factory work. The work that you do repeatedly should be easy for you to do, and you should really look for incremental improvements every time you do something so that you can do it better and easier. If you do this well, then your work will be easy, the normal kind of work that you do, and you should have some capacity to experiment, to innovate, to try new things, or to build on those projects that come from the president's office without anticipation in advance. So
one of the other things that's really important, we really want to get this across, is the importance of informal conversation. Eric and I met in 2009 or 2008, I believe, and we met in a personal enrichment class at the university. It was a meditation course, and so we got to know each other. We got to know what each other did, what we were working on, and so we thought it was really important for us to kind of sit down and, once in a while, as much as we possibly could, and start talking about what's going on with us, you know, what are you doing, just kind of catching up sorts of conversations. Another important thing to remember is that the library and the public web team had been having conversations with the Digital Scholarship Lab too, but distinctly, separately. And these were more project-focused things. What's going on? How can we help? How can we work together sorts of more formal conversation. And it was during one of those formal conversations with the Digital Scholarship Lab that we learned about this request from the president. So the library got its project from the president through the conduit of the Digital Scholarship Lab. Now, the library and the DSL, we knew that we could do this work. We had some sit-downs up front. We planned out some ideas. We knew we could do it, but the question was really, how well could we do it? So during one of mine and Eric's informal conversations where we were just catching up, that's when we really kind of expanded the concept of the project out to, instead of, you know, two units doing this on their own. Why don't we bring together experts from different areas in the university and let folks play to their strengths? And it was honestly that excess capacity that Eric was just talking about that enabled this work to actually happen. So one of the things that we did right up front was get into this mindset of success. Right after forming our team, we sat down together and we had to really think about these questions, those four questions, and then the fifth is an action. But these are what we did right up front.
Okay, so the first question was, can we do it in 9 weeks? So we weren't sure, honestly, and but we really didn't have a choice, and it seemed like it'd be really interesting if we were successful at what the outcome would be. So we wanted to just get going and do it. So the first thing that we thought about was, for us, the public web team usually work with one academic department at a time or one campus unit at a time to get work done. Here we had an extra group in this mix, and actually the two groups that we had in the mix, the Digital Scholarship Lab and the library, we had really never worked on these kinds of projects with them before, so there was a big unknown there. So if you look at this plot, we have the multidiscipline, this is one of those magic quadrant plots, it's not, you know, an XY plot, but on the left is the multidisciplinary intensity, and for us it was high. We also had, luckily, the sponsorship of the president, and we were able to operate in the sweet spot here. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, though, you don't want to do complex projects with low sponsorship, okay? I mean, I think that's a sure sign that you're going to have a high potential to fail. So you really want to work in the green space if you can. So
one of the things to remember, though, is that working in that sweet spot and presidential sponsorship or the sponsorship of a dean or a CIO, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to have a successful project. The only thing that it really guarantees is you're going to have more stress in your lives, and you're going to have this increased risk or increased aversion to risk.
All right, so the first thing that we did when we formed the project team was really think about how we were going to motivate people, because we had 9 weeks, and we really didn't have 9 weeks. The president needed to get this application early so he could seek to discover some things, hopefully, from the application and the data set. So we had about 8 weeks to deliver, and we were really needed to make sure people were motivated. So this concept is really important, and this is about people, right? This is about working together. It's not about technology or tools or even the ultimate outcome. It's really about the fire in the belly. So we wanted everybody on the team to have the fire in the belly. And as a manager and as a project manager, I can't give you the fire in the belly. You either have some flame or you don't. But I tell you what, as a peer or as a manager, I can throw water on the fire in the belly and put it out. I can also flame it a little bit and make it a little bit bigger. So motivation comes from within. This is a great little book. This book was published in the 90s. Called the Project 50. I suggest that if you're interested in this topic that you go read it. It's really about how you make every project seem more like a wow project. I like the word cool better than the wow factor, but this is really important. So now let's consider historically the folks that have done things great in the world. What kinds of behaviors did they have? What kinds of energy did they have? So take Thomas Edison, right? Everybody knows who Thomas Edison is. They did 10,000 experiments on the lead acid battery and they all failed. And he was like, well, we know 10,000 things now that didn't work. Let's try 10,000 more things. And about 20,000 they did is when they finally got it. You can see those characteristics up on the slide. Thomas Edison had all of that. So it's important to be committed. It's important to have passion. It's important to have a uniform vision of the project, which is what we're going to talk about in a couple minutes. So one of my jobs was to get up the fire in the belly and get it flamed a little bit with all the project members. We did that by talking about the coolness of the project. And we have Scott's coolness. Now, Scott was lucky. Scott's a, He's a PhD candidate in history. He's in the Digital Scholarship Lab. So this is historical data. This is kind of his bread and butter. This is what he really loves to do. So we really didn't have to work with Scott much on the coolness factor. This is Matthew Levy. He's a user interface manager. His job is to make sure that user interfaces work well and they're seductive and useful. He had a lot of different things that were cool about this project. One thing was that this was an opportunity to work on something entirely different than the public web pages, which have a lot of similarity from site to site. So this was going to be entirely different. Another thing for him and others was HTML5 and Canvas back in 2010 when the browsers just started supporting it. My coolness for this has nothing to do with the history. I'm not really a history nut. I have a daughter that is, but I'm not. I like to go home and code or something. I'm just kind of a geeky guy, right? So for me, it's about getting work that people say we can't do done and done well. That's what's cool. And that's been kind of my mode of operation throughout my career as a project manager and as a kind of a technician. And for Chris?
And there are really three things that were really cool about this project for me. The first being, you know, I like my job. I like what I do most days. And the idea of getting this content out to users on the web was pretty exciting to me. The other thing that was cool was the fact that we're going to be using the exist native XML database. Our data was all in XML, and I liked the concept of using for an academic project the same kind of platform that was being used to drive content out administratively for the university. And really the third thing was getting all of these experts in the room together, getting folks who are good at different things marching towards the same goal. And that was really, really quite nice.
So the next thing was, what are we really doing? What is the project that we're doing? And what kind of outcomes, other than the 9 weeks and the things that Chris mentioned earlier, were we trying to come up with and achieve? So we did this exercise called an is and it is not exercise. And this is really important, and I think a lot of people that are given requirements or given projects, a lot of you probably, how many of you get projects where you really don't even have requirements, right? Somebody says, hey, I need X, right? And then some of you get books, right? You get requirements, a stack of requirements. And how many of those projects ever end up being what's in the stack? Usually not very many, right? Because stuff changes as you're going along. So this is a way to start to pull out requirements. And we had choices. The project team, with some conversations with the president, had an opportunity to drive what this was really going to be. So everybody wants to know, what is it, right? And everybody does some form of is, whether you do this formally or informally. We also do is not exercises, because to get a uniform vision across the project team members, it's really important to know what the project's not, okay? That way people don't work on things that we're not really wanting to deliver. And if you notice in the middle of the is not, it says Adobe Flash. This was not going to be Flash. We have an aversion to Flash on our websites now because of a variety of reasons, one of which is Flash isn't supported on the iPhone and the iOS devices. We declared that right up front. If you also look under that, it says it's not going to be boring, and I apologize, but it's not going to have an academic look, right? We wanted this to be attractive to the nth degree. We wanted middle school kids to be able to kind of look at it and use it, even if they didn't really fully understand all the visualizations, but to come in and use it and really say, hey, this is a really pretty site.
One of the other things we decided up front that it was not going to be was just another search engine. And that's one of the things that digital library projects sometimes turn out looking like. Having a page images with OCR behind the scenes is great if you're doing volume work, if your goal is to get a whole lot of text online quickly. But we were working with really intricate XML data. We had the TEI transcriptions, we had the voting data, we had the census data, and it would have really been a waste of all that data, of all that work, if we had just made it a search engine.
Okay, so we had 2-week sprints. At the end of each sprint, we have to deliver something that somebody can at least look at and potentially use. And that's one of the Scrum concepts that we practice. The importance of that is, without screenshots and screen designs and all of this up front, we didn't know exactly where we were headed. And this is a truism that has played out for me on all the projects I've ever done. Users don't ever know what they want. They only know what they don't want when they see it. So Scrum gives you that ability. They can see it faster, say, no, I want it to be different this way, and you can zero in much faster on the final target. Okay, so then the next thing is, how can we leverage our work culture? Okay, now this is somewhat complicated. I'm only going to skim the surface of this. If you're not familiar with corporate and academic culture models, organizational culture models, I'll have a book reference in a second that you can go out and read. But I suggest that if you're in charge of projects or in charge of people who are in charge of projects, it's really important to understand your local and your organizational culture. All right, so the question was, how can we leverage the culture? And this is a book that I've used, and it's got a culture model that looks like this. There's lots of different culture models, by the way. They all have different words. This one works for me. Find the ones that work for you. So collaboration. Most people know what collaboration looks like. Most people know what dysfunctional collaboration looks like. Everybody gets in a room, and they leave and go, wow, that was a really great meeting. And then somebody says, well, what did we decide? And what are we doing? It's like, I don't think we decided anything. So that's dysfunctional collaboration. So what you want is functional collaboration. You want to get out of the meeting and have tasks and have direction, okay? Control on the left side is you have a plan, you work the plan, you don't exceed the plan, but you meet the plan. IBM, for the most part, being a giant organization, is a control organization. The Army is a control organization. Control organizations are the only culture that can scale to gigantic sizes. You would probably not be surprised that your controller's office, your finance people, are probably more like a control culture than any of these others, because they have certain things they have to get done to the plan, and you know, monthly reporting, yearly reporting, and all of that. The lower left-hand side, cultivation, looks like collaboration, but it's for a greater goal. And those, you don't tend to find that very often, and when you do, they are in religious organizations and nonprofits is typically where you find those. And the lower right-hand side is competency. So this is about the self. This is about the deep self and getting skills and competencies built for yourself, okay? Microsoft is a competency-based organization. They're a meritocracy. People are rewarded for their own contribution, not the success of the project. Hopefully you won't be surprised that much of higher ed is competency-based because of tenure, right? This is what faculty do during their PhD studies. They go deep and they keep going deep, right? So that can create some collaboration problems. I hear some chuckles in the audience, right? So you have to know what your organizational culture is, and then you have to also know that you have localized cultures that can be very different and you can leverage them. So our localized culture for the public web team was collaboration. And we're lucky that way, that we had folks that were naturally collaborative. And I have a team member who's competency-based. Now, he deals with everybody and he works great, but we give him every day, he's got something to do that increases his skill set, and that's what satisfies him.
Now the library probably won't surprise you either. And this is my take on things, the library, we kind of tend to see that being a more competency and almost that cultivation. We're very passionate about the fact that what we do, we're doing it for the greater good. But for some projects, especially when you need to execute work really quickly and really well, and you might not necessarily have those skills within your organization, it's really important to kind of pull yourself up towards that collaboration quadrant. So that's what we tried to do with this work with the library and the Digital Scholarship Lab.
So one of the things the public web team had done up front, and this is a recommendation we have for you if you have a need to work collaboratively, is to develop a cultural leverage strategy before you need to use it. So years ago, we had to migrate 50 some odd sites from arts and sciences into a new content management system. And we developed a strategy that took into account culture to do that. And we wanted to identify players that tended to have a collaborative nature and put them on the project team, folks in arts and sciences. So we found two and we did that. The next thing we needed to do was to get those players to act as interfaces to everybody else in arts and sciences. So the dean, the department heads, faculty, coordinators, administrators, all of those folks, for the most part, they acted as interference to those people for the team. That allowed us to remain collaborative. The other thing is to be aware, okay? And we're gonna talk about awareness in a couple minutes at greater depth, but be aware of your culture, be aware of individual team members' strengths and how they fit into the culture and how they don't, and what can you do to make it better, to give everybody a more satisfying job, and to allow the productivity to rise and naturally come out of doing good work. So, and as my job as project manager on this was to run interference for the team. I mean, I managed the stand-ups and other things, but really it was when stuff came up that was unanticipated, you know, go track it down and make sure it didn't stop us from getting our work done. Okay, so the next thing is, what if we fail? Okay, I see this in corporate America, I've seen this in academics. There tends with a lot of folks to be fear of failure. All right, so we don't fear anything. Okay, this is our rendition for copyright reasons of The Sharktopus. And I don't know how many of you have seen this movie, but this is a sci-fi movie. The Sharktopus is something to fear. We label projects as Sharktopus projects. These are the big, ugly, complicated ones. And this one was exactly that, okay? But we really didn't fear it. And the reason we didn't fear it is we were aware of our risk because we spent time up front doing risk analysis and risk planning. So simply put, create a risk plan. So what is a risk? Well, risk is just something that can happen that has a negative impact on your project. It can be anything, right? Risk have a probability of occurring, at least your assessment of a probability, and they have an impact. To keep it simple, you can use low, medium, and high, and you can put a number on it, 1, 2, 3. So you have 3 times 3, a high and a high. That's a more costly risk than a 1 times 1 equals 1, right? So you can get an impact assessment, and then you can start to figure out the cost, and you work on the bigger ones first. And so working on them, what do? Well, you come up with a mitigation strategy, and mitigation is how to keep the risk from happening. So now, in a former life, I was actually a bank compliance advisor, which just baffles me that I actually went through that in my life. I'm much happier in higher ed, being a geek. But we had a project that had to happen. The regulators were asking us to deliver on time, and we had a hurricane barreling down on us. Well, you can't mitigate a hurricane. You can't stand outside and go, stop. You know, there's no mitigation strategy. But there are contingencies. What can you do in the event that the hurricane actually tracks through Richmond, Virginia? And we did, and we had a plan. We had extra batteries for laptops. We made sure our cell phones were charged. We had airline tickets to fly out when the project was ready. We had alternative plans to drive to another airport should the airport be closed, and luckily it wasn't, and we delivered on that. So break your risk down and have a column in a spreadsheet, mitigation and contingency strategies. Sometimes there's multiple mitigation strategies just to make it a little less likely to occur or a little less impactful, and sometimes you have multiple contingencies. All right. So here's an example from this project. We're not going to be ready for the president. That's kind of an oh no, right? I mean, we're supposed to be delivering for the top guy at the university, right? So what was our plan? Well, we were going to have 2-week sprints so that we knew within a 2-week window how far along we had come. And we only had 4 sprints, right? We had 8 weeks until he could play with it, find some defects, discover some things. We were going to add features incrementally as we go in each sprint. We would declare what features we were adding in each sprint, which allowed us to then deliver those features at the end of the sprint in a demonstrable way. And we would polish the app later. Luckily, when you're demoing something and when Dr. Ayers was at Gettysburg in the National Archives, he could avoid hitting the buttons that really didn't work, right? And we did add some polish and some visualizations later.
The contingency for this was we would evaluate 4 weeks out and say, are we going to make it or make it at least well enough? We would work overtime. We were already working a little bit overtime because we were doing our other work as well, but we all committed, the project team committed to, we were just going to get crazy and work unbelievably long days. And then, if it wasn't going to happen, we would set expectations and have that ugly conversation with Dr. Ayers. Luckily, it happened. So that's really important on complicated projects that have high visibility or high impact. If they fail, do some risk planning and practice. Start small. And if you're not sure how to do it, find a project management class. Many universities teach project management in their continuing education programs. Go sign up for it. If it's a good project management class, they're going to talk about risk planning. All right, so the next thing is steer the ship. So Chris is a sailor. I love sailing too. So we found this Creative Commons picture on Flickr. It looks pretty good to me. So, you know, you have to actively manage your projects. And you have to think about what can happen on a project. So now this is an XY plot on the lower. The X plot is something that leads to complexity. It could be a variety of factors. Here we have, for ease of understanding, multidisciplinary intensity. On the left is the risk of failure, which is either the sum or of threats and impediments, or the sum of the threats times impediments. But some measure of complexity, and or some extra measure of risk. As the complexity of a particular project can rise, the risk is going to go up. The risk of failure is going to go up somewhat exponentially. All right. And so what you want to do is really have it be on the desired line. You want it to be flat and scale at a pretty slow, low scope. But we have driving forces that always drive us to failure, right? We can all say what those are. Turf wars, not my job, inconsistent prioritization across four groups. People don't work together well, cultures don't mix. I mean, lots of driving forces. But you have to steer the ship, okay? And so you have to intentionally have strategies to pull that curve down to the desired level and reduce your risk. So we've talked about that. Project coolness, managing the culture explicitly, Scrum as a project management approach, and just generally attitude. Okay, I mean, I think all of these are very, very useful. So now let's kind of sum this up. You own it. You own your work. There's really no excuses for not getting the work done in most cases. Yeah, sometimes technical things don't work out. That's different. Okay, here's some other things that we think are really, really important. Know where you are. Be aware. David Schwartz yesterday talked about awareness and as a leadership competency. We're big believers in awareness. We met in a meditation class. We think everybody should be aware of their strengths. We think everybody should practice metacognition. You should go home at night and go, what worked, what didn't, and then you should forgive yourself for the things that you didn't do well. Awareness is really good. But then you need to be aware of your peers, your manager, your subordinates, and how they all work. This poor guy's sitting on a railroad track. The tracks look rusty, but maybe the train comes by once a month, okay? Be aware of your situation.
One of the other things to do is experiment fearlessly. Most projects aren't perfect right up front, and some of our work is never perfect. But that doesn't mean that we can't play around. For the CIOs, the directors, and everybody in the room, build plans, or better yet, allow your teams to build plans that allow them to take risks, to stretch themselves out, and really just play around once in a while. You obviously can't do this with student and employee information, or with risk management, or financial data, but we think the advice is pretty sound for the type of project we're talking about. And it's also important to remember that people do really good stuff when they're told something can't be done or if it's impossible. So challenge your crews once in a while, too.
And then, again, I'm harping on it, make your everyday work easier to do. You don't have to set out to make it really easy right off the bat, but every 2 weeks, evaluate it. Say, what can we do better? kind of have a retrospective on what you do repeatedly and get to where you can do it really fast. When we started moving websites into a content management system 6 years ago, the first site took 3.5 months. The next 7 took a month. Then we did 50, including content changes, in 3 months. Okay, so the velocity of site migrations increased. Because every time we were done, we said, what can we do better? What worked? How can we even make what worked work better? So this is really important. For those of you that have work that repeats, and I believe probably most of you have some work that repeats, really think about making it a little easier each time for yourself. That gives you capacity to think, to fearlessly experiment, to innovate, to have more capacity to do other projects.
And I think everybody in the room knows that guy. That is the honey badger. And the honey badger really doesn't care about failure. He knows that he doesn't let the potential for failure affect the final outcome. He's gonna eat that cobra, no matter whether he gets bitten or not. So the honey badger doesn't fear it, so why should we? Why should we fear failure? We should be that kind of steadfast and devoted to our vision that we won't let anything get in our way.
Roadblocks. We all have roadblocks. They're technical roadblocks. That requires usually technicians to solve. But most roadblocks that we encounter are due to culture. They're due to people. They're due to sometimes processes and people systems that aren't working right. Roadblocks can be a mindset, though. And we've found, and Chris and I see people all the time, they're like, oh, I can't work with that person, and you can't collaborate. It's like, why not? But success can be a mindset. It really can. And we set out to do this. You saw the user interface, at least the screenshots of it, and it looks great. We had no idea what it was going to look like. The designers had to create that design. So we had to create a vision in everybody's mind, and we did that by the is and is not exercise. We did that through conversations about coolness and what are we doing, and we talked about the project constantly. Those conversations about talking about what are we doing, why are we doing it, they're not wasted time. It's not heads down work for 2 weeks, and then everybody delivers something different and it doesn't fit together. Those conversations that happen daily are actually really useful to your efficiency. And that's kind of counterintuitive to people that are not used to those kinds of conversations.
And this is something that is obvious and really speaks for itself. Caffeine helps, or whatever your stimulant of choice is. It was no different for this work. We drank a lot of coffee and brown soda, probably to the detriment of our health.
And last but certainly not least, don't get comfortable. So I think if you saw the keynote yesterday, higher ed's changing, whether you believe it or not. 10 years from now, many schools are going to look different. Some schools are going to disappear and new schools are going to replace them. Your jobs are going to change. The technology you use are going to change. The way people work together are going to change. The way people collaborate are going to change. This changes, and I thanks for all of you. I see folks mostly paying attention. I've been into a lot of presentations in the last couple days where people are doing double duty work, right? That's changed. We go out in the hallway, people are walking with their phone in their face, right? Bumping into things, right? Things are really different now. Don't be buggy whip manufacturers, okay? Keep looking to change and experiment. Don't get comfortable. And that's it. The slides are up on the website, the EDUCAUSE website, and there's some things if you want to go see some of Dr. Ayer's presentations. I believe he's going to mention at least this project at the keynote. And we have time for a couple questions. We have microphones, so please, because this is being recorded, if you could step to the mics, that would be great. All right, we have one brave soul.
Hi. For your team members that were working on the project for the 9 weeks, how much of their time was dedicated to the project?
Wow, that varied a lot. Up front, the designer and Matthew Levy, the user interface manager, probably spent 40% of the first 2 weeks on the design.
But after that, that went down a lot. Matthew Levy did some of the coding, so he probably spent 20% of his time on subsequent. For me, as project manager, I probably spent 20% or 15%. Chris probably spent nearly 100% for him. He had other team members on his library team that could absorb some of his normal work. But he was tweaking the TEI and making sure the markup was clean and doing all of that. Scott Nesbitt, I have no idea. I don't think he's, Rob, do you have an idea how much time? 25%? So we probably talked to the president, I don't know, 6-7 times during that period. Okay. Other questions? No?
For the Scrum-ish, so what didn't you do with Scrum and why?
Okay, so the question was, for Scrum-ish, what didn't we do? We don't have daily stand-ups, and we don't commit to getting all the stories and tasks completed in a sprint. The public web team works on anywhere between 30 and 60 projects concurrently. Some of these projects are one person for a couple hours, and some of them are big, ugly projects that take months. We can't predict when external impediments can be relieved and freed up. So we can't predict when a particular campus unit can actually get back to us with feedback on their content. And so we don't commit to getting certain work done in a certain time period. For this work, we did, because this was a bounded project. So we knew at the end of each two-week period what features we were going to deliver. The stand-ups we hold are twice a week. We don't do daily. For this project we did, it was nearly daily stand-ups. So that's kind of some of them. It's a longer conversation, so if you want to catch me afterwards, we can talk in greater detail. So,
I think you just kind of spoke to it a little bit, but could you talk a little bit about internal communications and how you kept people updated while still allowing them time to work?
So how we kept people updated on the project, team members or external? Both. Okay, so team members during stand-ups, and then we had constant collaborative meetups all day, right? Not everybody all day. I mean, Chris and I might meet on one particular thing. So, but during stand-ups is when we talk about where we are and what the status is. A few emails. We use Basecamp some with some projects, so we do some statusing in there. Did we use Basecamp? I don't think we used Basecamp on this project. So externally, we just talked with people. My boss is sitting right here. We meet weekly with all of the directors and vice presidents that report to her, and we just talk about the work. With Dr. Ayers, the Digital Scholarship Lab, and Rob runs the Digital Scholarship Lab, he's sitting over here, they just had conversations with Dr. Ayers. We didn't make a big deal out of the project externally because we didn't know it was going to work. Afterwards, then, there's press releases and the normal kinds of things that you might want to do. All right. I have one more question.
For project members, especially from the different offices, who were, let's say, less or not experienced in Scrum, how did the team go about sort of bringing everyone into the same world
environment? Do you want to take that since you were one of those?
I'll say that I had no idea what Scrum was when we first started this project. And it was a get tossed in the deep end sort of thing. You know, we sat down with a whiteboard and a bunch of post-it notes and tried to figure out what those stories were, what those things that we wanted to accomplish with the project were, and then putting tasks up underneath each story. It was kind of learn as you go thing, but honestly, I think Scott and I were really the ones who weren't really into Scrum up front.
And as we exposed people to Scrum for the first time, I draw a lot of pictures and I talk about what a good story is and what a good task is and all that. I'm a certified Scrum Master. I came to the University of Richmond a little more than 6 years ago, and I had several years of Scrum experience when I was a bank compliance advisor on crazy, like really, truly crazy projects. So I'm a certified Scrum Master, and if you're interested in, you can actually go to one-week training and become a certified Scrum Master. You don't have to have practice. yet to do that, but it's nice if you actually can operate in a Scrum-like fashion a little bit and get training. I'm also a certified Scrum practitioner. I haven't kept that up because there's not much value to me in it. It costs $300 to do that. And that basically says that I have a lot of experience doing it. So I've done business process projects and IT projects and development projects and, you know, bank decision letter projects and all kinds of crazy stuff that I prefer to forget about. But I draw a lot of pictures and I explain and I read a lot about it and I try to keep my mind fresh on what the current state of Scrum and Agile is. And it seems like 6 years ago there was very little Scrum in higher ed. Now I'm starting to see a lot more about it. And it's not for everybody. There are some projects where there are certain teams that just can't handle it. But for those that can, it's really productive. Okay, any more questions? I think we're virtually out of time. Hopefully you enjoy the rest of the day with the keynote in a couple minutes, and safe travels.